Welcome to this podcast from Barlow McCarthy. We hope you find insight and a catalyst for change in the topics we discuss. Now here is today's presentation.
Good day, all. This is Allison McCarthy from Barlow McCarthy, leadership coach. And I have the pleasure of welcoming with me today in this podcast, Sarah Wilcox. Sarah and I have worked together in the same organization very early in our careers, when we were young and just starting out trying to figure out how to be a woman in business. So we go back a long way, but her career has advanced since then to span the C-suite as an executive, to launching new businesses and being an entrepreneur, managing people across many different disciplines. She now focuses on helping women navigate their careers while integrating their professional and personal lives, as well as consulting and training within organizations. She recently gave a talk on leadership and empathy, which I think we'll hear more about in this podcast. Sarah began her career in journalism, so it's no surprise she has recently authored a book entitled, Is This Really My Life? And I'm going to be referring to it in some of my questions. She received her MBA at the College Graduate School of Management at Northwestern University. And in between undergraduate and graduate school, she finished coursework for an MFA in Latin American Literature and Creative Writing. I'm delighted to see my friend Sarah back here again. Thanks, Sarah, for joining me.
Thanks, Allison. It's so great to be here with you.
Terrific. So, Sarah, you have chosen to focus your consulting, mentoring, coaching business today on women. Can you talk a little bit more about why that focus?
Well, it was sort of a natural spot for me to land, actually. You know, I had been on the corporate side for a long time. And then for the last decade, I was working in an entrepreneurial capacity for different startups. And when I decided that it was really time for me to give back, I found that I was getting asked a lot of questions by young women in business. And one of the reasons is that women don't have historically mentors. They're not as networked as men are. There's been such an evolution of the role of a woman in business that all those things have changed. There's some very fundamental things that haven't changed. One is that women still are responsible for over 60% of the household chores and the childcare. So if you're a woman going up the corporate ladder as I was, you know, that's a lot to juggle. And the things that have changed, I think the paradigm shift in work has gone from this need or desire to find work-life balance to actually living a fully integrated life, which means there just aren't the walls, there aren't the barriers that we used to have. So, I mean, if COVID was, you know, really brought this to bear, and it had been going on before COVID, but what we saw is that women were at their kitchen tables working alongside their children who were doing their homework. Their spouse may be in another room working. The dishes are in the sink, the laundry's in the washing machine. That's like a full-on integration. And so I thought I could help. And so I decided to go the more natural route for me and with my experience and my expertise and share that with women who are in the business world today.
And for women of our generation who are on the other side of our careers, do you find that we have some resentment about seeing younger women being able to do more of this integration?
I personally don't. I applaud it. I'm so excited for them. You know, I think one of the things, Allison, that's different is there are a lot more women in roles now, in leadership roles and management jobs, just in the workforce than when we were there. So there's a lot more camaraderie, I think. You know, I love when I hear stories of women who are taking new jobs and the other women are giving her advice and counsel about how to negotiate salaries, you know, what to expect from the boss, you know, and the role at large, you know, that makes me feel happy that actually we have made improvement and we have moved along, because, you know, it's a cohort group. And most people in the workforce have cohort groups that they belong to. It can be gender, but it can also be level of responsibility. It can be, you know, race, culture, language, ethnicity, technical skills. So we all sort of live in business in that cohort group. And that's where we get affirmation, right? That's also where we get information and advice and counsel. And the fact that there are now more women in business makes that a much more doable, usable, you know, important group. So I'm very happy to see that women are helping. You know, the road that we paved was hard. And I think that one of the things that I see happening too is that women can be more authentic about what they really want in today's world, where we couldn't. I mean, you know, there were so many barriers, and we just kept pushing through them and pushing through them. And I know that many times in my life, I was probably more assertive or aggressive than I personally wanted to be, but I felt that if I didn't push to have my voice heard and I didn't push to have a seat at the table, that I was never going to be able to succeed at the level that I wanted to succeed at, which is why, you know, when I work with young women, I bring to bear a coaching tool set, I bring to bear mentorship, and I bring consulting, because you know, most of my clients, whether it's at the corporate level or it's at the individual level, want to hear what from me, because I look like them, right? I've had that journey already. And how did I succeed in it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, helping at the end of the day, helping them find their way.
Yeah, great. So one of the themes that I, as I read your book, because it's really my life, one of the real themes that I felt in it was using the examples of your own experience, talking about this integration and some of the myths and misperceptions of that integration. So what did you hope that book would do for those that were reading it? Which I encourage lots of people to go get it and go read it, because it's a great read.
You know, I wrote it during the lockdown, and there were a couple of reasons why I started writing it. One was I wanted to bring some humor back in people's lives by telling stories that were funny, because I do feel that one of the ills of our society today is that we don't laugh anymore. We just get mad. We don't see the irony. We don't see the absolute just ridiculousness of situations. And worse than that, we've also lost the ability to laugh at ourselves, which, you know, there's actually something physical that happens to you when you laugh. It's a stress reliever. It's the thing that you do. It blows out the stress and it gives you that opportunity to sort of clear your head and your heart at the same time. So I wanted people to see that you can still laugh at yourself and be successful. You know, you can still point out your mistakes and the foibles of your life and still be successful. So I did that, and using a lot of examples, I also pointed out things that I think are very important, because in finding careers that have meaning and purpose, because I do think that is a younger generation need. And I support it 100%, because I think it's a healthier way to live. And I have a lot of clients who will not work for certain organizations because they don't like what they stand for. Or they know the way that they treat employees. And so they're not even willing to give it a shot to apply, which is why we have now CEOs taking a hard look at moving from shareholder value to stakeholder value, because it is important how you treat your employees, how you behave in the community that you're serving. So I wanted to affirm for women that it's okay to want that, and you can go get it. And here's some tools to help you do that. So it was a sort of a double and whammy in terms of why I went about writing the book.
Oh, and some of the stories were quite hilarious and had a lot of irony in them, which, yeah, so it was a great read. And,
oh, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
You know, imposter syndrome is one of those phrases that gets identified with women leaders quite a bit. That comes with fear of failure, lots of perfectionism tendencies. But in your book, you describe failures as just attempts at trying something new, and that you emphasize that success is an attitude, which I love that phrase. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. You know, in our culture, we give lip service to trying new things, being adventurous, you know, being the innovator. And when we go to work, we're often also given lip service of don't be afraid to make a mistake. Don't be afraid to fail. And then you do, and it's not well received, right? So what's happened is the idea of attempting something is now fraught with a lot of repercussion and retribution in some cases. So I want people to understand that when you try something new, you can't be perfect at it. I mean, if Malcolm's book about the 10,000 attempts to be perfect at something, right? It takes time to be really good at something, and it takes effort. And so to castigate yourself because you tried something and it didn't pan out the way you wanted it to is really being very hard and uncivil to yourself. And so what I would like to encourage my clients to do is to go and do something that they've always wanted to do, but don't expect to be perfect at it, whether it's rock climbing or it's, writing a book or it's taking swimming lessons or it's trying to come up with a new product idea. The expectation should be set where it needs to be set, which is why, success is an attitude. If you try something and it doesn't work, just try something else or keep trying. There's that too. So I think that the success is an attitude is more about being kind to yourself and allowing yourself to not be good at something. You know, type A's have a terrible time with that. And I think that, forgiveness of ourselves, especially in this day and age, is very, very important. And we're changing drastically. So our need to try new things is heightened from 20 years ago. We need to try new things at work all the time. There are new services, there's new technical equipment we need to understand, ways of working. You've got to be willing to give it a shot and not be great at it the first time out the gate.
And so I suspect as part of your consulting, you have to encourage organizations
Yes.
to allow for the failures as well, the trials and the failures, because if the environment's not there to support it, mm-hmm. it's hard for an individual to step out there and do it by themselves and not face repercussions.
Right. I do the work that I do with organizations is usually three levels, right? It's the individual, it's the cohort, and it's at the organizational level, which is usually the leadership level. And bringing home how change actually occurs, right? Because it occurs at the individual level, a certain way, at a certain pace. Groups of people change, teams change, based on certain criteria. And it could be affirmation, it could be support, it can be resources. I mean, there can be a number of things, right, that promote change there. And at the organizational level, it's not giving up on your KPIs or your success metrics, which is what most leaders spend the majority of their time on. But it's also incorporating into that the knowledge that you've got human beings working for you. Things are not going to go according to plan every time out of the gate, and allowing that to be okay. Now, having said that, I think it's also important to put some parameters around that, because you can't tank a company and you're trying, but you can certainly look at different ways in which way you can promote people trying something new without it happening, you know, ruining your business. And I think that kind of attitude, those kinds of messages that come from the top of an organization really give teams and individuals and groups an opportunity to make some really remarkable changes that are, in the end, good for the organization. You know, the thing about working within the organization is that the interdependency of the individual, the group, and the leadership, and that one needs the other. And what I try to do also when I talk to leaders, especially, is to understand that because we are in an environment where the majority of teams are slim, right? We don't have a lot of fat in our organizations anymore. You cannot afford to have a weak link, therefore, in your team or in your organization. There just isn't room anymore, which means you either need to groom that person, support that person, help that person, or you need to move them to a place that they could be more successful. But it's not fair to anybody else on a team to have a weak link. The other thing is, if you're a team leader, you deserve to have opinions and voices and ideas coming from every single person on that team, which means that you need to promote the idea of equality, that everyone has a right to an opinion, and that everyone has a right to be heard. And so that's a culture shift too.
Yes.
And especially, I work, as I said, in a lot of male-dominated organizations, and they're just starting to come around as more and more women come into the fold. Because the truth is that women and men do work differently. You know, I always think about humor with men versus women. It's very different. You know, when guys get together and they joke around, women would not find that funny for the most part. I mean, they take like really sensitive subjects and they start making fun of each other over it, right? Well, that kind of thing, we need to be clear about what it is that women and men are bringing to the table. Women are masterful multitaskers. You know, and we need to take advantage of the things that each of us brings to the table. And we do bring different things. People from different cultures bring different things to the table. People with different technical expertise bring different things to the table. So as a leader, it's really important in this day and age, especially as things change as quickly as they are. And, you know, we're working very differently than any of us have ever really been trained to do, that we invest in hearing everybody, which is, you know, goes back again to empathy and high EQ too in the leadership suite. So.
Yeah, that's great. I think you've, you know, referenced the pandemic and working more from home. How will that change expectations of employees from a leadership perspective, but also how does it change how you lead when it's really more of a virtual work mm-hmm. world and not an on-site work world?
Well, tremendously is the answer, really. You know, many relationships between leaders and their employees has been very transactional. And we actually moved into a vein where, I mean, if you think about like generations ago, how people stayed in their jobs for 20, 30, 40 years, right? And it was considered home by many. And then as things changed, we became more mobile and the world changed and businesses became more competitive and more of them. What happened is we ended up in a very transactional world where I will give you my skills for a certain amount of money and you will keep me as long as you need me, but not a minute more. And so that relationship was one that we could move in and out of quite easily. There were plenty of jobs for a period of time and salaries were continuously, you know, going up. Well, there are other intrinsic needs that employees have now that we've moved into a pandemic and remote work. And what we're finding is that a lot of workers don't want to go back into the office. And so, you know, if we think about this, what makes me laugh is the thinking about those people who thought that they got a lot of merits for showing up early and staying late, right? That's gone. I do think that we're going to have to find ways to connect personally in person, at least, you know, at some point, because I do believe it's a human need, that connection. But I don't think it's a 5 day a week thing. Most of us work on computers, the majority of us, besides frontline workers and essential workers. I'm not talking about that group. But the people who have had their lives change a great deal are the office workers who work on computers and do a lot of single contribution type work, or work through a project manager, right? Who's constantly sorting everything out. So do you really need to sit in that cubicle for 10 hours a day? The answer is no. What you need is to find ways that your team can come together and brainstorm and laugh together and connect, so that when you each go off into your own home offices, that connection can carry you through conflicts, disagreements, you know, idea generation. So the role of the leader is less about making sure everyone's marching to the same drummer. It's really a role of, how do I help you? It's the servant leadership role of, how do I help you be the best that you can be in this job? And what do I need to do to make sure that my team is performing? And so it very much is more of an emotional relationship to leadership than we've ever had.
Yeah, totally agree. And how we assess or measure people's performances really then has to start to change, because it's not, you know, task oriented. It's, you know, there has to be metrics. The metrics are very different, less tangible, way more intangible.
And we had an example of someone who just assumed that no one was working a full-time job and fired the majority of the company, right?
Right.
And so I think that to your point, we can't make assumptions, you know, or project. I mean, there are people who can get their work done in 4 hours. There are people who take 12. And that shouldn't matter. But I think, to your point, I think it's about treating people like and forcing people to be adults. I'm hiring you to do this job. I don't care where you do it or how long it takes you, as long as that doesn't impact the business. You need to be on calls. You need to be, you know, if you're a client-facing business, you need to maintain those relationships with your client. I mean, those are the metrics, right? What do you need to do to perform? And you know what area is probably the best at looking at those kinds of performances? Sales.
Absolutely.
You know, because everything is incentivized behavior. And so I think what we're going to do is start looking at, how do we incentivize people to do the things that we want them to do? And it no longer is being at the office morning, noon, and night.
Yeah, correct. And so, you know, then it sort of gets into that squishy area of compensation and contribution, and how do you financially reward people for levels of contribution when it's not based on work hours anymore? And positions and titles and all of that is going, I think, to morph. What do you think?
Well, I don't think compensation is as difficult as the title and the organizational structure, because I do think that you reward people for their contribution. And once you identify what that contribution needs to look like and what the deliverables look like, then I think you can figure out a compensation package. What I think is really different is, why do we have titles? We have titles because we needed to set up a hierarchy. And that was for decision making, it was structure, and it was compensation. But I think that that's the area that probably has less meat in it at this point than what we had before, because we're pretty flat the way we're working. You know, if something needs to be coded so that you can get a product out the door, that's as important as making sure that the media buy is where it needs to be to pull in the qualified prospects as it is to the finance department and making sure that your cash flow is there. So it's less about I've been here longer, whatever, than I don't think that matters as much anymore, as long as we are helping people get done what needs to get done. And I think that that may end up helping us to be less judgmental and less cavalier about the people that we have working for us. Yeah. It's going to take time. I mean, you know, I work for a very large organization. They have something like 80,000 employees. And, you know, there's a lot of legacy systems and perceptions that we're going to have to overcome. This won't happen overnight. But I have to bring up one thing that has changed that I'm seeing. With the pandemic, we have a mental health crisis on our hands. And that is going to add burden to leaders because that's significant. It is an epidemic in this country. I see it with a lot of people I'm working with, high levels of anxiety and depression. I do think that that is going to have to be dealt with time off, you know, the way that when people work. So we're going to have to deal with that somehow. And I do think that's a new burden for leaders that no one is ready for.
Yeah, I heard somebody yesterday say to me, the messages from leadership sound schizophrenic, which is I need you to work harder, produce more, be more efficient, reduce costs, etc. But you need to take care of yourselves and your family. And she said, so which message is the real one there? Because it sounds like it's in conflict with each other. Right. Yeah, I don't think we've figured that out yet.
Well, you know, especially if you're a public company, you know, the market is so crazy and will continue to be up and down with the new variants and whatnot. And no one really knows what's going to happen from an investment standpoint. I do think that CFOs who drive a lot of the decision-making in organizations, you know, they talk really a language that's more an investment language than an employee language. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, in a meeting with the CFO was talking about why we need to be more efficient so we can create more profit so we can buy more companies. Okay, as an individual employee, why do I care? I don't. You know, could we talk about higher wages and more compensation for working longer hours, dealing with the stressful situations that we have to deal with? You know, that's not a message for employees. And retaining employees at this point is incredibly important. And it's huge. And, you know, wages have been stagnant for a long time. So when people see an opportunity to get better benefits and to make more money because inflation is what, 6%, they're going to take it. So you can't be cavalier about what's important. The employee is important because otherwise you don't have a business.
That's exactly right.
If no one's selling it, making it, talking about it.
That's exactly right. Right. Because most of what we're talking about is not widget based. It requires a brain behind it. And the other part I see, I would love you to comment on, is our ability to have honest, transparent, but difficult conversations. When you describe the hierarchy piece as part of that old structure, we haven't really learned how to have open, honest, difficult conversations about what each person is seeing, boss to employee, employee back to boss, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Part of it is I think we don't have the words, but I also think there's an anxiety that's built in. I don't really want to have this conversation, so let me just avoid it. But until we start learning how to do that, we're not going to learn about each other enough, as you're talking about. And we're not going to have these difficult conversations at the top of organizations to figure it all out.
Yeah. You know, conflict is something most people try and avoid. And there are very few of us who are good at it. You know, we either go over the top or we, you know, hold their tongue and never address it. There's not a lot of in between. And I do think, you know, that we've talked about EQ and empathy and, you know, and I talk about this in my book, there's really no way around any of this. You have to spend quality time with yourself. You just have to. Self-reflection is one of the only ways that you can address your own behavior and the things that trigger you in ways that are not success oriented. So, you know, a screaming, yelling boss, for instance, thinks that he's getting across or she's getting across what they want, but all they're doing is alienating the people who work with them. And the message is, you know, oh God, don't upset this parent. You know, it's like a parent thing, right? Oh, don't rock the boat. Right. So I think that it has to start with who we are and how we want to be treated and what our fear is that will happen if I do address this. And, you know, again, most of us have a worldview and a belief system that's built on, you know, early experiences and situations that we've encountered that, you know, led us one way or another in terms of how we approach conflict. So I think you have to really address that. But I think at the end of the day, we often look at hard conversations as conflict riddled, but they don't have to be. You know, having a conversation with an employee about expectations is not a conflict conversation. It's really, it's a way that someone can actually understand what they're accountable for, right? And what is expected of them. Showing up on time, you know, doing the tasks that are on your plate and in your job responsibilities. You know, it's those kinds of things, though, that leaders get really sort of weirded out about, you know, and it doesn't have to be a conflict. Telling someone, look, we are expected to meet this revenue goal. Now the question for all of us is, how are we going to do it? Doesn't have to be the you're not meeting your revenue goals. You know, it doesn't have to be set up that way. Okay. And so I think you do have to look at the way in which you interact with people, your ability to have relationships with people. Do people trust you? Do they avoid you? Do you have just surface encounters with people? Do you ever have those deep conversations about what's important to another human being? Or what they value, or what they don't. So I think a lot of it is just in the way in which we approach the hard conversations. But you have to look at yourself. There's no easy way around that.
That's right. Exactly. So this has been such a great conversation. I know you and I could go on about this for hours, as we have done many times before, but as you look at your own personal journey, and one of the things you say in the book is a lasting win in life is not a career choice, but one where people I love, admire, laugh with, and carry on with are all at my table. For those who are early in their career journeys, what else would you say about that?
What are careers? They're a way of exhibiting performance, right? In things that you like to do. So if you think about why you ended up doing the things that you're doing, it's because you liked it, right? For the most part. Now, if you're not, then that's a different conversation. But careers are fleeting and they change all the time. I mean, I think that one of the things that we think, and I work with a lot of young people who are looking for their career. But what I try to tell them is you don't go from A to Z overnight. It takes time. And the journey is fraught with all kinds of potholes. So you get laid off. You know, your company merges. You know, they only need so many people. I mean, there are so many things that can happen in a career. You can make a wrong turn and, you know, find it difficult to find your way back again. There are so many things that can happen in a career. A career is just something you do because you like to do it. But at the end of the day, when we're ready to retire, having people you care about and who care about you, that you can laugh with, that you can share with, that you can do things with, companions, that's to me a good life. Making money and working feeds something that we each of us has to be productive, right? Productive members of society. We want to contribute, and we do it working for nonprofits, we do it working for for-profits, we do it for older companies and startups. And, you know, it's all very exciting and it feeds that need of ours to contribute. But the relationships that we cultivate along the way, I mean, look at us, you know, 30 years we've known each other. Those are the things that are special about life. Those are the things that keep you going when the pothole hits. Bosses come and go, jobs come and go, but people are really important.
Right.
And I think that becomes really the whole theme of your book and clearly is the theme of what you bring to your coaching and your mentoring and your consulting. Sarah, it's been great to have you with us and so appreciate your time here. And again, Sarah's book is This Really My Life. And Sarah can be reached at sarah@womenincludednow.com. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Allison.